Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 22nd of September 2021, and this is Reconstruction with me, David Taylor, from the Construction Index magazine, joined as usual to discuss the week's news and related topics by Phil Bishop, editor of our online news service. How are you doing, Phil?
I'm very well, and I'm pleased to say that there's no risk of you and I running out of gas this week, is there?
Well, certainly not hot air. We'll do our best to keep it flowing. Although I'm a bit frustrated. It's been a trying week so far. All my tech seems to be ganging up on me. Literally, I nearly took my printer outside and shot it yesterday because it refused to print. And my oven wouldn't work because the clock's on the blink. And if the clock's not working, the oven's not working. I mean, where's the logic in that? And my washing machine blew up last week. And I'm going to call them out. Currys PC World. I bought a new machine from them because, and only because, they could deliver it the next day. It took a week to arrive. So there we are. So anyway, things are beginning to settle down, but I'm still a bit frazzled.
Talking of trouble with old tech, not exactly the same, but I need to post something to DVLA to get a form. And I have to send a cheque for 25. I haven't written a cheque for years. I don't even have a chequebook anymore. And somehow I've got to try and find a cheque to send to DVLA.
I think you can. Can't you legally write a cheque on anything?
Oh, is that right?
I don't know. I might be getting my wires crossed here, but I'm sure I remember many years ago a farmer writing a cheque on a cow and sending it to somebody. I don't know. So in the back of my mind, there's this bizarre belief that you can actually legally write a check on anything. It doesn't have to be on a check from your checkbook. So, try it, Phil.
I know that there certainly used to be a thing that you could stick a postage stamp on anything. You could write an address on a cow and stick enough stamps on it that they would have to take that.
That's right, because Esther Ranson used to do that all the time on BBC, didn't she?
Oh, did she?
It's the sort of thing she used to do. Oh, God, really showing our age now. Never mind.
Right, we're digressing. Let's get back to gas shortages.
Yes, indeed, yes. Quite serious, actually, this, isn't it? It seems to be, there seems to be a shortage of just about everything, not just washing machines. Sorry, I'm going back to that again. But everything seems to be in short supply all of a sudden. And the bizarre thing is that today's news is that it's CO2 that we're short of. And after all the talk about too much CO2 being emitted, all of a sudden we haven't got enough. So what's going on?
It stumps me. I know we're supposed to be talking about carbon capture and storage and so on. Mm. I don't know if that's carbon dioxide that they store or what it is. I'm you're the more scientifically minded David. But why we haven't got enough carbon dioxide when at the same time we've also got too much of it. Yeah. I don't understand. Can't we just put a plastic bag over the back of the tailpipe of a car? Doesn't that work?
Yeah, that might not be a very efficient way of doing it. I suppose that the problem is...
That's nitrous oxide, isn't it? Or something...
Well, I don't know. There are all sorts of nasty things come out of tailpipes. Carbon monoxide being
that's
the worst
the
thing.
That's but, the one. Just do it twice then.
Yeah. I think the problem is not so much that we've got a shortage of CO2. We've got the same amount of CO2. It's just in the wrong place. We're still generating it. It's still coming out of tailpipes and, you know, I don't know, from all the buildings. Yes, everything. it's not going where it's supposed to go, which apparently is into the food chain. Into the food chain and the nuclear industry. Apparently it's used for cooling gas reactors. And in fact, there was a report in the Times this week that the government might even have to close down its 6 advanced gas-cooled reactors because of the shortage of CO2. So it really is fascinating and a bit alarming to see how interconnected everything is, that it's like a sort of a domino effect.
Well, we can't shut down the power stations because the wind turbines aren't turning because there's not enough wind, apparently.
Not enough wind. Not enough sun because we're going into autumn. Yeah, it's a bit worrying. And of course, the CO2 shortage is a direct result of the increase in natural gas prices, I believe. That's the way I've read it anyway, that this company, one particular company, US-owned company called CF Industries, produces something like 30 or 40% of the UK's CO2 as a byproduct of fertiliser production. And because they use a lot of natural gas in fertiliser production, they thought, well, you know, we can't afford this. It's not economic. So they've closed down their two plants. And all of a sudden, all these companies which rely on this, which to CF Industries is just a byproduct, CO2, say, where's our CO2? You know, we can't make fizzy drinks. We can't slaughter pigs and chickens. We can't do this, that and the other. I didn't know they use CO2 for slaughtering pigs, by the way. I think that's a bit gruesome. But, you know, all of a sudden, you've got these other things happening as a result of the natural gas price increase, not to mention all these small energy producers, which apparently were supposed to be at the vanguard of decarbonising the economy. They're all going out of business because, you know, they've been undercutting each other and people have been, you know, switching all the time, and now they're uneconomical. So it's all blowing up in our faces, isn't it?
But apart from no bacon sandwiches and no Tizer, what are the implications for the construction industry? Is there much?
Good question. I don't know. I don't know how dependent the construction industry is on CO2 as a product. Not used for fuel. Might be used for cooling, maybe. Maybe it's, you know, sort of dry ice, maybe used in heating, ventilating, cooling, possibly. I'm sure somebody from the from BISRIA or someone like that could put us right on that. I don't know whether it's used in construction very much.
But let's widen this out. I mean, it's not just shortages. It's the knock-on effect of shortages, of course, the price goes up. Yeah. And the big thing, it seems to me, is the electricity prices. I've just read in this article that was in the Financial Times yesterday, the British Steel, which is now Chinese-owned, mm-hmm. of course, said it's been quoted maximum price for electricity up to £2,500 per megawatt hour, whereas back in April it was paying £50 on average, £50 per megawatt hour. So £50 compared to £2,500 per megawatt hour. And electricity is a large part of the cost of steel production.
Yeah.
So I think steel's already just about doubled in price in the past year. So we can imagine what's going to happen to rebar price, structural steel prices.
Yeah.
The price of steel, I don't know, there's some suggestion it's already gone up, it's already been factored into it, and it might start to come down. I don't know, but that is a...
That's massive.
Huge.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... I think the food producers, going back to CO2, were saying we've got about 10 days until consumers start noticing shortages of food products in the supermarkets. That's fairly short term, actually, because 10 days isn't very long. But I think over the next few months, we're really going to see prices of all sorts of things increasing. I mean, certainly if the price of natural gas and electricity are going to rise at such an alarming rate, that's going to have a massive knock-on effect on building materials. Yeah, everything. Yeah, so it is rather worrying because, of course, we've been congratulating the industry over the past 18 months for the way it's weathered the COVID storm and the fact that, you know, sites have kept open and the industry has continued to prove quite productive and, you know, people have been letting new contracts. Hasn't slowed down progress, but all these factors, I mean, cost increases, there's no easy way around those, really. I mean, if things cost more, then everybody has to pay, basically. So I think we're going to see that next year.
We had the latest monthly update from the Construction Leadership Council on construction materials supply issues this morning. And they're saying that it's a bit chicken and egg, this. There's been some levelling off in construction demand, but that's because people can't get the materials. And you know, prices are going up, so clients go, ooh, how, we'll pause on this project till we either work out the money or see if prices are going to come down a bit, and then we'll start. So the constraints, I think it's more constraints is a better word than shortages in this context. The constraints in the supply of construction products and materials has impacted construction activity, and as construction activity has been impacted, so the demand for materials has reduced, and it's sort of self-leveling to a certain extent in some areas. And to quote the Construction Leadership Council, and this is this monthly statement is put together by the what do they call it, the Product Availability Working Group, which is co-chaired by the man from the Builders Merchants Federation and the man from the Construction Products Association. So we've got on the one side the people who sell and distribute this stuff and the people who make the stuff.
Yeah.
And they're saying in their update today, there has been some easing in the shortages of bulk and bagged cement in August, because we I don't know if we've talked about it before, we've certainly reported it before, that cement has been, there have been waiting times and shortages, and there have been more imports of cement as well, more cement coming in from abroad. But this is what they're saying. They're saying the main concerns are around bricks and blocks, with some regions experiencing increased delays in securing supplies. Concrete roof tiles are averaging 24 to 30 weeks lead time. So that's like 7 months. They're still saying bagged cement's an issue, but it's not as bad as it was. Transport issues continue to be the most common and pressing concern across the supply chain. We've talked about that before, and the shortage of HGV drivers, which is not something that's going to be sorted out in the short term. And they say that the price increases have started to moderate, but this may be short-lived due to continued pressure on costs of raw materials, labour and transport. Energy prices, particularly the doubling of the wholesale cost of gas, is also a critical factor for manufacturers, along with the higher carbon prices related to the increased use of coal-fired power stations. So their conclusion is, we're not out of the woods yet. The supply chain is just about managing under unprecedented circumstances. Many factors could still cause disruption, but we're better than we were 3 or 4 months ago. So optimism, pessimism. Not quite sure how to take that one.
No, it's a bit of a mixed message. The thing which strikes me, I suppose, about this this whole sort of interaction of you know, things being in short supply and disrupted supply chains, is how you cannot separate these things out. They are interdependent. And, you know, I think it's a bit of a wake-up call for, you know, all those people who keep telling us, for example, that a transition to renewable energy and a low-carbon economy is a no-brainer, that we've got to go for it and all the rest of it. I mean, this has shown us how dependent we really are right now on fossil fuels, particularly, and how it's a juggling act. You can't just simplify things down to, oh, you've got to abandon this particular source of energy and you have to maximise that particular source of energy. The problems are compounded at the moment, for example, by, as you said, the fact that the wind isn't blowing particularly strongly. So all our wind turbines are standing idle. We've had some pretty good weather actually recently, but again, solar is a tiny contributor to the energy mix. We're still heavily dependent on things like natural gas, gas turbines, and of course, nuclear. And, you know, if the government's talking about closing down its advanced gas-cooled reactors because it hasn't got enough CO2 to cool them with, the whole thing is like a sort of a Jenga tower. You know, you remove or you disturb one element of it and everything else becomes unstable. So I think it's certainly worrying, but I think it is a wake-up call, actually. We've got to be a little bit more realistic about our expectations when it comes to energy, particularly.
Yes, there are people who cite climate emergency, it's time for revolution, not evolution. You know, we need sudden rapid change. But I've always been the sort of person that's more keen on, I don't like change anyway, at the best of time. My wife always tells me off for that. But no, I do understand, of course, we need to change. But evolution, broadly speaking, is more long-lasting than revolution.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
More durable.
Yes, absolutely. And I do, I think this does show a, you know, shine a light on the whole sort of climate emergency debate. And because I think people really have, you know, it's a serious issue that I'm not disputing that, but I think people tend to get sort of blinkered and they don't see the big picture. We know that there's a big energy crisis looming and we have to do something about it. We know that there's an environmental crisis looming and we have to do something about that. But we simplify it at our peril, I think. We've got to take a more holistic view.
Should we move on to another of the big issues of the day?
Let's do that, yeah.
Which is, God help me, this phrase, levelling up. We mentioned the cabinet reshuffle last week, and between us talking, and probably between listeners listening, I guess, almost, the announcement came out from the government that the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government was getting a new name, and it is now called the Department for Levelling Up Housing and Communities, which will go by the acronym DLUH.
Yeah, exactly.
And Michael Gove is not the Secretary of State for Housing anymore. He's now the Secretary for DLUH.
I agree with you that the phrase levelling up is pretty meaningless. I mean, when it was first mentioned, maybe as an idea, it had some currency a while ago. But it's, again, I think it's one of these buzz phrases which over time actually loses any meaning. I mean, once upon a time, when Boris Johnson was crusading up north and trying to sort of dismantle the Red Wall and suddenly realised that he actually had a constituency up there, levelling up, you know, was, I suppose, a response to, the phrase levelling up was trotted out as a response to a disaffected working class in traditional Labour seats, and it was a rallying cry. But now it's a department for levelling up, I think, it's become wishy-washy. It doesn't mean anything anymore.
I heard a discussion on one of the taxi driver radio stations the other day, and they had a woman from Maidstone and a chap from Durham or Northumberland or somewhere, and they're talking about what levelling up means to you. And the chap from the north of England was saying to the Maidstone woman, "You're already levelled up. You live in Maidstone. You don't need any levelling up." So he says, "Oh no, we want some levelling up too, please." So it clearly means all things to all men. But the idea that the burghers of Paisley, Portadown and Prestatyn are all going to have the same cars and share portfolios of the gentry in Putney is quite simply ludicrous. I mean, there will always be inequality. It's a fact. That is not to say it should not be the government's job and mission to iron it out, or more particularly, in my view, iron out access to opportunity, which is, I think, opportunity is more important than attainment, in my view.
Yeah, I think so. Give people the opportunities and, you know, let them take them. You can't force an opportunity on somebody, can you?
But I think where levelling up comes from, this whole thing, and it's the phrase I object to. I mean, it's just typical meaninglessness, I think.
Yeah.
But we used to talk about devolution and decentralisation, and that had quite a specific meaning. I mean, it could be interpreted and enacted in all sorts of different ways. But devolution, decentralisation meant the man in Whitehall not trying to tell the person away from London what to do. And it meant both a geographic thing, that whether it's Scotland or whether it's Leeds City Council, not necessarily having their own parliament. Scotland did get its own parliament. But for example, the mayors of Sheffield and Mayor of Liverpool and these sort of people have got much more power as local government leaders than they used to have. And so there's a movement of power geographically, but there's also, coupled with decentralisation, a sense, a sort of perhaps Thatcherite sense of small state, less the man from the ministry telling you how you should shear your sheep and how many hectares of crop you should plant where, and giving people a certain freedom to run their business, live their lives, and so on. Now, levelling up is, I think, it's got its roots in that. But the whole devolution, decentralisation discussion, movement, morphed in 2011 in the Tory Liberal Democrat coalition, 2011 Localism Act, and it all became a discussion about localism, which is sort of the new word for decentralisation, or the new manifestation of decentralisation. and it seems to me that levelling up is the third incarnation of this. It's, we used to talk about localism, but localism was a bit of a Cameron buzzword. And Boris Johnson will be damned before he uses any Cameroonian buzzword such as localism. Yeah. Actually, I'm not even sure that localism might not have been a Liberal Democrat buzzword. But anyway, it's part of the coalition day. And levelling up, it seems to be son of localism, is how I see it.
Yeah.
But in order for it to work, in order for the people of Paisley Portadown and Prestatyn to have what the people of Putney have got, in London, you've got government, you've got the government, national media, and you've got, most importantly, the City of London, the financial capital.
Yeah.
Arguably the financial capital of Europe, although perhaps not quite so much anymore. And there is this financial huge machine that drives London and the southeast and the home counties. And the reason why in Germany, for example, it's more the wealth is more spread out is because there's industry is more spread out and it exists, and there's finance in one part and industry in another part, and they exist. We have more industry than we care to think about. Industry is more than shipbuilding and iron and steel making. There needs to be more high-paying, well-paid jobs in the regions of the UK if the regions of the UK are going to have the sort of wealth that the home counties have. And so that's what it's got to be all about. It's got to be job creation. And all the government is doing at the moment, it seems to me, is moving civil servants out of London into these new hubs around the place. Now, civil servants are lovely, lovely, super people, but they're not wealth creators.
But then, this isn't a new idea, because, was it the Thatcher government or was it Major who sort of, encouraged companies like, Komatsu to open up a factory in Birtley up in the northeast, and, of course, other...
Well, the Honda at Swindon and Nissan.
So... That does create jobs and good quality jobs in these areas, which of course were decimated by the closure of all the mines. A lot of them, not the Swindon one, obviously. But so we know that is a way. And I would say that those industries, the car manufacturers and the excavator manufacturers up in places like the northeast, have been lifesavers for people up there. So. Yes, that's the right approach. Whether or not you would call that levelling up, I don't know. Because as you say, you wouldn't open a car factory in Essex.
Putney.
or Putney, certainly. Yeah, I mean, different sort of jobs, maybe. Largely blue collar, I suppose. But obviously with plenty of management jobs as well. I don't know. I mean... What does levelling up mean for Mr. Gove? Because, he said, I think in one of the reports I read, that he just said it was the defining mission of this government is levelling up. But I think the thing is that after the last election, the last general election, and one or two by-elections since, that the government has realised that actually the traditional Labour voting working class are pretty disaffected with Labour now, and that they have an opportunity to take their place, which is why, you know, these Red Wall constituencies are being fought over. And I think that they've realised that something which perhaps the phrase "levelling up," which was I don't know who coined it, but when it was trotted out first of all, didn't seem to have the potential which it now appears to have, which is that this is a way of extending our appeal to people in these traditional Labour constituencies, and that, you know, people who whose economy is built on industry, heavy industry, mining, energy, things like this, these are the people we need to appeal to. And there's no doubt about it. I mean, in the last couple of years, the Conservatives have done better with that sector of the population than Labour. You know, that's
no. I think that was a Brexit dividend. I mean, Thatcher and the party political split has always had fault lines. Labour Party has always had an Islington branch and a Transport and General Workers Union branch. I mean, there have always been two sides to the Labour Party. In the same way, there have always been two sides to the Tory Party. There's been the small c Conservatives, and there have been the sort of the Libertarian Radicals. And and it's the same sort of... and that follows socio-economic lines often as well. So I don't think the change... Well, I don't think the whole blue wall thing and the success that the Conservative Party had at the last election was somehow a tribal shift. I think it was more to do with the Brexit splits being manifested, that the Tory Party was seen to be the Brexit Party and the Labour Party was seen to be the anti-Brexit Party.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And I think that in the fullness of time will erode, and new identities, new definitions, new badges will emerge, that or the electorate will identify the parties in ways other than Brexit. And that's something I think Keir Starmer has yet to do. That's work in progress for him, but there's time. But what I find interesting about Michael Gove's power grab is that calling it his new department, the phrase local government has gone from there. And he's now saying it's for all the United Kingdom. The focus of the department is to look after overlooked families and undervalued communities across the United Kingdom. Now, his department previously didn't have any authority over Scotland, Northern Ireland or Wales. They had the devolved administrations. And he somehow... and he's also been given the special beat from the Prime Minister to stop the United Kingdom falling apart, to go save Scotland. Yes. And he is Scottish by background himself, and a frequenter of their nightclubs in the early hours of the morning.
So yes, still
a useful person, I think, more useful than Boris Johnson, to perhaps argue the case for the union.
Yeah,
he might be the secret weapon, one nightclub at a time. Talking of which, have you ever seen a politician dance and thought, yeah, I'll vote for them now?
No, I can honestly say that has never happened.
It never worked. I remember Theresa May not very long ago dancing to, was it Dancing Queen? They put on some walk-on music at the Tory Party conference or something. And every pair of buttocks in the country tightened a little bit when they saw that. And even Vince Cable, who's on a Christmas Strictly or something, he is an adequate, more than adequate, competent ballroom dancer. But even seeing him doing his ballroom dance, I kind of think, not sure. I mean, there could be an argument that said Ed Balls, you know, came out.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But he was no longer a politician then. And that said, Ed Balls, okay, you're not our Chancellor, but you're now a national treasure. Let's go do Panto. had he been Chancellor, we might not have felt quite so warm about his Gangnam style.
Hang on, there was another former Conservative MP who was on Strictly.
Oh, Anne Widdecombe.
Anne Widdecombe, yes.
That's right up there with Michael Gove in the nightclubs.
Yeah. Oh, well, how on earth did we get to that? Goodness me.
Okay. Yes. off topic. So off topic.
That's levelling up for you.
We did promise we'd save the gas shortage.
Has anything else caught your eye, Phil? Anything else you want to discuss?
Okay, let's do a 180 or at least a 90 degree right angle turn and talk about something completely different. There was an article in the Times newspaper on, I think it's last Saturday. Peter Tom, do you know that name?
Mm, I do indeed, yes.
Peter Tom, for those
who
don't.
The Aggregate King.
The Times called him the Aggregate King. He was one of the architects, the lead architect, perhaps, of aggregate industries in the 80s, 90s?
Late 90s.
Yeah. Merging Barden and Camas. And he sort of created aggregate industries before selling it to the Swiss company Holcim. I don't know how you pronounce these foreign names. And then he, after he retired from aggregate industries at well past retirement age, and then got going on a new venture, creating or building up. He bought a shell company. Again, not alone. He was with people, but he was very much the figurehead. Building up Breedon into one of the big aggregate and quarrying building materials entities. And he then retired for a second time from Breedon about 2 years ago, I think. He retired as chairman. And the Times has been talking to him, and he discovered he's having a third go. Age of 81 and retired, theoretically, to the Channel Islands, to Guernsey. He's teamed up with a former associate, David Williams, Marwin Capital, chap used to be, who was involved with providing the money or finding the money for Breedon. And apparently they're setting up, I know no more than what the Times article said, that they are setting up a new acquisitions venture to buy up building materials companies. And the Times quoted him as saying, there are a lot of family businesses out there who are finding themselves asset rich and cash poor. People are beginning to think about what's on the other side of the pandemic, that is, and about what happens next. So Peter Tom, it sounds like, if reports are to be believed, is having a third crack at, he's already succeeded it twice, but he's going for a third construction materials empire.
Amazing bloke. I mean,
he certainly seems a very colourful chap. He played for Leicester Tigers. He would have been what we call a professional rugby. It wasn't professional in those days, but he was a top rugby player in the 60s.
Yeah.
Front row, prop forward for Leicester Tigers.
I actually met him once many, many years ago. And in fact, I think it was even before. I think he was at Barden at the time. I don't know. I can remember very little about
mid-90s, early 90s, are we talking? Something like that, I'm guessing?
Yeah, it was at least that long ago, maybe even longer. I can remember very little about it, largely because of the only sort of lingering memory was my embarrassment, because I'd been sent by my editor over to Peter Tom's London headquarters to interview him. And I was woefully underprepared. I didn't really know anything about him or his business.
This must have been when you were a cub reporter still in short trousers and that.
That's right, yeah. With Construction News. So I went along there and sat in an office with him. He made me feel very welcome. Just me and him. And when I look back now, he was incredibly patient and indulgent. And I asked him what questions I had managed to prepare. And we talked about it. And he was... he was good value, you know. I'd ask him a question and he'd give me a nice full answer. And at the end, I very soon ran out of questions. So I said, well, tell us a bit about yourself, you know. I thought I'd add a bit of personal colour to it. And well, as you know, I'm not much of a sports fan, and I never played rugby at school. I went to the sort of school where. On a Wednesday afternoon, you had two options, really. You either played football or you went and smoked fags behind the bike sheds. Never played rugby and didn't know anything about it. And so he said, well, you know, I am chairman of Leicester Tigers. And I had no idea what he was talking about. I mean, it could have been a zoo for all I knew. And so I just sat there completely stumped, had nothing more to say to him.
You didn't start asking you about lions and tigers?
No. I didn't open my mouth, I think. I do remember a very embarrassing silence. And he said, the rugby club. Oh, I said, oh, yes, of course. Yes, quite. Oh, yes, fantastic. You know, it wasn't until years later I found he actually used to play for them. But, yeah, I found him, despite my ineptitude, he was, I do remember he was very patient and a really nice bloke, actually. And he could have made me feel very uncomfortable, but he did his best to do the opposite, I think. So that's my memory of Peter Tom. I've always had an admiration for the bloke ever since then, partly because he let me off the hook. And he's obviously a very capable businessman. He knows what he's doing and a thoroughly nice bloke.
I haven't had the privilege of meeting him, but everything I read about him, he does seem to be really quite genial and charming, yeah. and much, much loved and admired.
You must have met people in the industry who were similarly kindly disposed towards you, Phil, in your time of need. Have you got any lingering memories?
I just have to have a think. I tell you who was always a lovely man when I was a young reporter. I think I first met him when he might have been at John Lang still at the time. It was John Armit.
Oh, right, yes. Well, we all know who he is.
And he was always very, very genial and indulgent and patient with stupid young reporters. So, yeah, I'd put him in that camp.
Talking about nice people to deal with, near the top of my list would be anybody whose surname is Sparrow. For those in the crane hire business, Sparrow is a name to conjure with. It's a whole dynasty of people, Sparrows, crane hire. They're just all really nice people. That's all I can say about it. I've met a few of them in my time, but yeah, nice people to deal with, and you know, with a good reputation for business as well as being good to deal with.
Well, I've met two of them, and I'd say I know one of them fairly well, and on that basis I would agree with you.
Yeah, I think so.
Next week, ladies and gentlemen, David and I will be discussing the biggest bastards in the construction industry.
Now, I think we could actually talk for a lot longer about that.
So do listen in, tell your friends that will be the one. This is a version of audio clickbait, isn't it? I don't think we will have that conversation next week. And we're just saying it to make you click next week. Anyway,
yeah,
right.
There we are. Okay.
I think we've talked enough for this week, David, haven't we?
I think so, probably.
All being well, next week we might have a guest or two. We've got some interesting things up our sleeve.
Mm.
So do join us again next week if you can. Well, you don't have to join us next week. You can listen whenever you want after we've recorded it, because we're available on the internet forever and ever from all your usual podcast outlets. Thank you again for listening. If you want to get in touch, as usual, we're on podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. Let us know if you've been affected by any shortages, whether it's bacon sandwiches, Tizer, roof tiles, cement, steel, building materials, whatever. We're interested to hear your anecdotes and experiences of what's going on the ground. But for another week from David and I, thank you very much and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.